You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Teresa Brown is a former English professor who went back to school after the birth of her twin daughters to become a nurse. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times op-ed page, writing about healthcare issues, and now she's written a book that documents a single day working in the oncology department at a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania hospital. The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and I'm very pleased it has brought Teresa Brown to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, what made you leave your job teaching English at Tufts to become a nurse? You also taught at Harvard and MIT, and wouldn't most people want to move in the opposite direction, nurse to college professor?
Yeah, this is what I call the million-dollar question. And other people have asked me, are you crazy? Like, straight up.
Oh, I wouldn't ask you that.
But for me, after I had kids, I discovered that although I love books and I liked teaching and I think I was good at it, I just didn't feel passionately about it. And in my kids, I discovered a passion for what I call the mess of life. And then I had midwives when I was pregnant with the twins. And learning about midwifery got me into nursing.
Although you haven't completely abandoned your past life because you write.
Yes, yes. I completely did not expect to be a nurse who writes, but it's a very happy marriage of my passions.
Well, we'll get into all the time you spend in the hospital, and I'll ask you then how you even find time to write. But does your previous career inform your work as a nurse? I can only imagine that your interest in story and theme is a kind of an asset on an oncology ward.
I think that's definitely true. And the idea of being able to really listen to what people are saying, and in healthcare, we say people are poor historians. In English, that would be an unreliable narrator. So being able to just let people talk and figure out where they're going, yeah, that definitely helps.
So let's get to that, those 12-hour shifts. What's the origin of that?
It really started as a lifestyle change that nurses could work 3 days on and have 4 days off. But it also means we have a lot more control over the day. So, of course, at the end of a 12-hour shift, I am exhausted, but I also know that pretty much the whole day is covered by me.
My big fear would be to come into the hospital near the end of that 12-hour shift. I would think, knowing what I know about working an 8-hour day, that the grueling experience you have on a daily basis might really have an impact on your ability to make some decisions.
Yeah, and that's a fair complaint. There is data that shows after 10 hours, mistakes really go up. So I don't have a good answer to that.
How do you manage your family life around it? I'm assuming, well, because you get those days off, you can spend some time with them, but you're gone long periods of time.
Yes, and then even once I get home, I'm pretty much kind of dead to the world. The kids have adjusted. I have a great husband who cooks and is a dad, so that makes a big difference.
And you say in the book that you tended to call your family more often at the beginning of your career than you do now. Because the kids have gotten older, or just because you don't feel as guilty about being away for so long?
The truth is because calling home takes me back into that world, and the hospital needs me to be sort of a different person and very focused in a different way.
So you need to develop some kind of a barrier between your personal life and your professional life?
Yes. Yes.
Did you choose to specialize in oncology?
I did. My mother is completely fine now, but she had a rare leukemia, hairy cell leukemia, and there's a lot of cancer in her family, too. So this was an opportunity to give back.
Mm-hmm. And do you, now thinking about it, do you think you might have been naive in selecting it?
No, I don't. I think I knew what I was getting in for, but I think I was maybe a little naive about the toll it can take.
Well, you read about a moment years ago when a patient started coughing up blood. What happened?
Yes, and then essentially died a couple of minutes later. And we called in a code team and tried to save her, but we couldn't save her. And it was a really formative experience for me, but also that's what started my writing career.
Because you then felt that you had to figure out what had gone on?
Well, I thought if I could put the experience on three sheets of paper, I would feel better about it, which doesn't work. But I liked the piece of writing I had in the end and thought, well, aim high, I'll send it to the New York Times. And then they took it. So.
And now you write regularly for the Times.
Yeah.
Mostly for the blog, the Well blog?
I started on the Well blog and then switched over to Opinion. So that's what I've been doing for the past few years, so that I say I can, now I'm paid to officially be opinionated.
Did that experience make you feel like you were losing control, that you couldn't control the situation?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It really showed me that the unexpected can happen. Yeah.
Is the cancer ward a place where you see more drama than you might in other parts of the hospital?
Yes, I definitely think so. People get a lot of bad news, and the people you see in the hospital, the cancer patients, tend to be the sickest ones. Of course, obviously, a trauma ward is going to really be a high drama area, but yeah, there's a lot going on all the time.
And you want your patients to pull through.
Oh, of course.
Even though you don't have any control over the matter.
Oh, of course, yes. That's what brings me back to work, is wanting them to do well.
Did you consider the intensity and potential losses involved with this particular specialty when you decided to go into it?
No.
Do people talk about these things at school?
Not at school, no. At work, we would, though. At work, we would connect and help each other feel better about someone dying by talking about them.
Well, cancer ward was almost synonymous with death for many years. Has it improved?
Oh, definitely, yes. There are so many people we save now who 20 years ago we couldn't have. So there's a lot more hope, which is great.
Although there are some forms of cancer that still are often fatal, like melanoma.
Yes, or even the floor I worked on where we do stem cell transplants, roughly 50% of those people won't survive a year, either because of the treatment will kill them effectively or their disease will come back.
So how does that affect somebody who's working in that area and giving those treatments?
Yeah, it's hard.
Am I killing this person or saving this person?
Yes, that is a very, very difficult question. And I know they would all die without treatment, so I try to focus on that. It's also made me really value my kids and my family life. I'm so glad I'm healthy. It's given me a lot of perspective on what matters, which sounds like a cliche, but it's true.
How long is a typical stay on the oncology ward?
It can be a couple weeks, but for newly diagnosed patients, it's 6 weeks. For transplant patients, 4 to 6 weeks. It's a long time.
I'm speaking with Teresa Brown, T-H-E-R-E-S-A Brown. Her book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Do patients return over time?
They do, and we really get to know them, which can also make it even more difficult when they don't do well.
Because you get attached?
Yes.
Isn't there an attempt not to, and then patients complain?
Well, I don't think any of us were really good at not attaching. And in fact, a nurse said, once you stop caring, that's when you need to go into a different specialty. So we might try, but it never worked.
When you arrived at work on the day that you're writing about in this book, you found out that Ray, a former patient, had been readmitted. Why was everyone so attached to Ray?
Ray, and his real name is Doug Weaver. I name him in the acknowledgments. He's just an amazing person. He's a firefighter. He played in a punk rock band. He's got all these tattoos. He seems to have the peace and calm of a Zen master. He's just a really inspiring person. And watching him go through this was difficult because he's also very young. He has young kids. He and his wife are very close. So he came to mean a lot to all of us. We really wanted him to do well.
Let's talk about some aspects of your day. How much of a lunch break do you have in these 12 hours?
Well, if I'm lucky, I'll get 5 or 10 minutes to...
Really? Out of 12 hours?
Yeah. It's not good. Yeah.
How many patients would you be typically dealing with during a typical shift?
Usually 4 for us. And some nurses have said, well, you're lucky. I never had fewer than 8. These patients are very, very sick and have a lot of needs. And so that's why 4 is really a handful.
And is there any continuity? Do you get assigned the people you had yesterday or last week?
If they can, they would always do that. Yeah. And nurses are really good actually at giving what we call report. So the night shift nurse tells me what was going on with the patients, and then I leave report for the next shift that's coming after me. And in fact, doctors say that nurses are much better at doing what they call handoffs than MDs are.
Well, some nurses will tell you they're often better at diagnosing the situation than the doctor. And that must be very frustrating.
It is. Healthcare works the best when doctors have faith in their nurses and listen to us.
Well, how hierarchical are relationships at hospitals? Wasn't one of your most discussed columns at the New York Times about doctors bullying nurses?
Yes. And I should say it's a minority of doctors and a small minority, but they have an outsize effect because their behavior is never corrected or often not corrected. And so they set a tone.
And what was the reaction of doctors to you when they read that?
Some doctors said...
Some of them must have recognized themselves.
Yeah, well, I did have a couple people say, was this me? And I said, no. And some doctors said, you go, Teresa, you're exactly right. And then others were not happy, and I actually effectively got called into the principal's office and got reprimanded for writing that.
Airing dirty laundry.
Yes, for airing dirty laundry.
You also write about one of the doctors kidding, I think, asking you if you'd bring him a cup of coffee if he asked.
Yeah, right.
So what did you sell him?
I said, well, sure, if I could bring it back and pour it all over your head. And
he must have loved that. Do you think the hierarchy goes down from the nurses also? Are nurses nicer to the orderlies?
No, unfortunately, nurses can be very hard on aides and transporters. And in fact, an aide once told me, no matter what happens, I know that Teresa won't yell at me, which I guess says that I'm nice, but it's not a good comment on nurses in general.
You cite a study that was done that reveals that previously a nurse would suggest some procedure in a way that allowed the doctor to take credit for it. Is that still happening?
That definitely can still happen. I think this patient needs X. What do you think about that? I think we learn all these different strategies for getting what we need for our patients.
So the doctor still feels like it's his or her final decision.
Right. The new generation is very different. Things are much more collegial.
A typical day involves certain things, like what happens in report?
Report is when you find out what went on with the patients on the shift before, but also from the very beginning, what their diagnosis is, what their treatment plan is.
And what is voice care?
Voice care is taped reports. So the nurse goes in and actually verbally tapes, like using a tape recorder, but it's through the phone, her report on each individual patient, and then I can come in and play that through my phone.
And you say it's a little like a spoken word poetry slam. Do different nurses have different styles?
Definitely different styles. Some are like they're giving you a haiku. Others, you're getting the James Joyce version of patient care.
Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
That must be fun.
Yeah, with all the acronyms and abbreviations and even our little codes that we have. Yeah, when I first started as a nurse, it took me a while just to understand even what people were saying.
You start out a shift with 3 patients, and you write about Richard Hampton.
Mm-hmm.
Why was he on the ward?
He was a lymphoma patient, a frail, fairly elderly gentleman, and the decision was made to give him this very toxic drug called Rituxan. Well, it's very toxic for some people, so I was quite worried about how he was going to do with the drug because he already was having trouble breathing.
Well, some of the drugs that interferon, for example, can have terrible side effects. And many people decide not to take them simply because the treatment seems to be worse than the disease.
Yes, and interferon is in roughly the same category as this drug, Rituxan, that while people are getting it, they can have rigors, their pressure can really drop, just a lot of really bad things can happen, and it's a tricky balancing act.
Everybody loved one of your patients, Dorothy Webb.
Yes.
Why?
Because Dorothy kept a candy dish in her room, and she stocked it with huge bags of Hershey's Kisses.
So she knew that she was going to be given better treatment. Another patient, Candace, gets admitted to a transplant as assigned to you, and you categorize her as a PITA. What's that?
Yeah, pain in the arse. Yeah. Yeah.
So they're total opposite, she and Dorothy.
Yes. But in the end, what I hope comes across is that I really admire Candace because she just doesn't take any guff. You know, she is the empowered patient, but in healthcare, we sometimes find the empowered patient annoying.
And then there's Sheila Field, who doesn't have cancer, but she's also in the ward.
Yeah, she has a blood disorder, so we're oncology and hematology. But it actually turns out that she has a very serious surgical problem.
And she has a perforation.
Yes.
Why is a perforation dangerous?
Because if you get a rip or a tear in your intestine, then the contents of your intestine, which are food, and are leaking into your abdomen, which is sterile, and bacteria start to grow, and that just becomes a really, really bad infection called peritonitis.
Mm-hmm. She, for a while, her attending considers the possibility that she has HIT.
Yes. Heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, a rare...
Oh, no wonder it's called HIT.
Yeah, right. A rare condition that's a response to a very common blood thinner that we give people.
It should be pointed out that Candace, the pain in the butt, gets what she wants.
She does. Yeah, she does.
So she didn't have to use the candy. What's the protocol for giving somebody bad news? That's got to be the hardest part. Do you leave that to the doctors?
Sometimes the doctors insist that we leave it to them and they won't tell the patients right away, which is very difficult. There's no real protocol for it. Often we're there to sort of mop up after the doctor delivers the bad news.
You talked about the tape that is that the nurses make to pass on to the next shift. But what about documentation? You're somebody who is a writer. I suspect you prefer to write out things longhand than to sit at a computer. Isn't everything done at a computer these days?
It is, and computers have become all about recording every possible thing we can about patients, and that is becoming more and more and more time-consuming. So we end up spending a lot more time with the computer than with the patients.
Do you think that's a response to the threat of litigation?
I think it's litigation. I think it's regulatory. It's wanting to know that before Medicaid reimburses, X, Y, and Z was done the right way. I think it's all well-intended, but the effect is not good.
Why is the possibility of falling such a big issue?
Because people can get really hurt when they fall. For our patients, they often have a very low platelet count. So if they fall and they hit their head, they could bleed into their head, and that's a very bad thing.
There's an article in the business section of the Wall Street Journal about the expansion of codes that doctors use in paperwork and monitoring. Will that expansion affect you as well?
It could. If it tends to slow things down, or if it makes diagnosing people so complicated that it's hard to get treatment started. I think we're just now dealing with the new ICD-10 codes, so we'll see how it goes.
How do you deal with visitors, or is that not your job?
No, we have 24/7 visiting hours. People sleep over, we'll get them a bed, and it can be great, and it can be very hard.
Well, they could be Candace's as well, can't they?
Yes, they can be.
Do you ever wish that you were back in the classroom?
No, I don't. I have never felt that, not once.
And this does give you an opportunity to talk about some of the big issues that literature has dealt with, life and death.
Exactly.
I'm sure that when you read Leo Tolstoy's The Life and Death of Ivan Ilyich, you recognized things in your own profession.
Yeah, and that's such an amazing book because it gets to the heart of what it's like to be in pain and be suffering.
I remember reading it and thinking, well, they didn't know the word cancer at the time, but this is an obvious description of someone who has cancer.
Right.
Do you ever imagine writing a novel based on your experience?
I guess I have thought about that, but it's no more than a fleeting thought. I still feel pretty wedded to nonfiction, but you never know. A novel could come out someday.
Meanwhile, we have this book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. It is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. My great thanks to Teresa Brown, RN, for being my guest today.
Thank you so much.